Morning.
Can you close the door? Okay. So, the subject of our study is the true nature of self and dharmas. What I have chosen for our text is this little book that was printed by what shall I call it? Gold Mountain, the Gold Mountain Monastery. It's called The Hundred Dharmas, the Shastra on the Door to Understanding the Hundred Dharmas, by Vasubandhu Bodhisattva, with a commentary of Tripitaka Master Hua. So I want to talk about who is Vasubandhu and who is Master Hua. Master Hua was a Chinese teacher. You probably know about him. When I was came to study with Suzuki Roshi at Sokoji on Bush Street, Master Hua had a temple around the corner on Sutter Street, Sutter and Laguna. Sokoji was on Bush Laguna. And I had been studying with maybe 6 months or something like that. And there were a few of us who, somebody said, you know, there's this Chinese guy in the corner. Tolan was his name at that time. And we should ask him if he'd give us a sashin. I didn't know what sashin was. We didn't, at that time, I hadn't sat sashin with, I don't think I had sat sashin at Sokoji. And, you know, we were all very novitiates. So, one of us asked Tolan if he would do sashin. And he said, yes. So the four of us did sashin at his place on Sutter Street. And we didn't know what to expect exactly, but we all sat down in the morning and did sashin, and like, it was, you know, really crazy because we never sat that long. And he would come in every once in a while and give us a talk, you know, and he was waiting for one of us to have enlightenment. And we all did. And I remember during the breaks we would go out in the alleyway and laugh and laugh and smoke a cigarette. Because you build up all this energy, this potent energy, you know. And so when we went outside, we just all burst out, you know. So he should have kept us inside, but he didn't do that. He was a very interesting guy. At lunchtime, there were all these Chinese ladies bustling around in the kitchen while we were sitting, and they made this huge feast every day, and big Chinese wonderful meal, and we'd all talk and laugh and everything while we were eating, you know. So it was a different kind of sashin than the one that we were used to, or you know, that we're now used to. And I remember he had a he opened his, you know, robe, and he showed us where he had burned his beads. It's a big scar on his chest where he burned his beads. Chinese, you know, have this Buddhists have this kind of ascetic practice of burning this and that, you know, like when you were ordained, they take a punk and burn little holes in your skin on your top of your head. And some people have two or three, some people have four or five, depending on their degree of devotion. That's very common in Chinese Buddhism when you're ordained. And so, you know, sometimes also, you know, there was a tradition of cutting off a little bit of your finger as well as a sign of devotion. So they had these kinds of practices, which fortunately we don't have in our practice. We just have sitting all day long without moving. So that was Master Hua, and then he moved to this little street in the mission, but this big, he called it the Gold Mountain Monastery. And it was a big warehouse, and that was their first big monastery from Sutter Street. And then they moved to the City of 10,000 Buddhas, which was this big mental hospital complex. And so that's where they have the place now. So Master Hua, he did a lot of lecturing. Edward Kanze, who was a great translator, would come down and work with him too, and he'd work with his students. And I remember when he was he was also in Chinatown for a while, in translating Sishin. And his students would all be sitting down below studying Chinese, and he'd be sitting up on his seat, and they'd be talks, and then they would all discuss. He and his students, a lot of them would, they would know Chinese, and they would discuss the meaning of the translations and how to do that. And his method of translation was to always have a committee that translates and not just one person, so that you get a variety, you work out and agree on what the meaning of the translation is. So that was his method. He died several years ago. So is Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu are one of our ancestors in the lineage. Vasubandhu Daiosho was one of three brothers. Two brothers, Asanga, his older brother Asanga, was a wonderful Mahayana philosopher, so to speak, practitioner. And Vasubandhu was what we call Hinayana, for lack of a better word, practitioner. They were both, all three of them were very intelligent, but the younger one was too far removed and too young to participate with the other two. So Vasubandhu was really very critical of the Mahayana. And he wrote the Abhidhamma Kosha, which was a work on Abhidhamma, which is a classic, but it's in the Hinayana tradition. And so his brother, Asanga, asked him, he said, he was clever, he said, "Well, you know what I'd like to do is to have you read to me these Mahayana sutras." And so Vasubandhu started reading the Mahayana sutras to his brother Asanga. And then Vasubandhu, at the end, he realized the Mahayana and became a Mahayana a practitioner and scholar. So this shastra on the door to understanding the 100 dharmas seems to have been his first Mahayana work. There's some controversy, like, is this Hinayana Mahayana? It's kind of, it's sort of in the middle, quasi Mahayana. because it's his kind of transitional work from Hinayana to Mahayana. Now, in the olden days of Buddhism, after Buddha, there were 18 schools that we count of Buddhism, which all had different viewpoints about the Dharma. And so what made them individual schools was the fact that they had different viewpoints. So, most of the schools had studied what they called the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma means the higher Dharma study. So they would classify all the Dharmas. And I gave you a couple of examples. I give you an example of the Sarvastivadin 75 Dharmas and the Theravada 84 Dharmas to compare with Vasubandhu's 100 Dharmas. That's not it. You see, it says 85 and 75. That's the 85. The 85 is the one vertical sheet, and the 75 is the one horizontal sheet.
82.
82. Yeah.
There's two sheets, right?
There's three sheets.
There's four.
Yeah. Three, four. Four. Okay. So, I don't have the 84 one, unfortunately, but we're not going to study that. We're just going to look at it. I just want you to look at it and see what those dharmas look like. And it's on two sides. So, most of those dharmas are, what are dharmas? Dharmas are you can, in a very broad sense, you can say everything that we experience is a dharma. Both rupa dharmas are dharmas of form, and then there are mental dharmas, chaitas, which are dharmas of mentality. So, mental and physical dharmas are what we're concerned with. We're not really concerned with so much with the world of dharmas. That's also a concern, but what the Abhidhammas did was to concentrate on the psychophysical dharmas of a human being. And that's what the lists are. And so the dharma is a thing. The things that are manifested as psychological and physical. And that's what the lists are. They list all those physical and psychological constituents that were always that actually constitute a non-self. So we can look at all these dharmas that are manifested by our mind, because all of them are manifestations of mind, according to this understanding, this model. They constructed this as a model of a human consciousness, human consciousness, because even the form dharmas are mental. That's why we say form and mental are not two different things. Body and mind are not two different things, even though we kind of separate them as body and mind. But when there's no body, there's no mind. And when there's no mind, there's no body. So it's really one piece. And if you look at the 75 dharmas, which are Rasa-Vasana, it's easier. It's less dharma. It begins on the left-hand side with the form dharmas. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, form, sound, smell, taste, and so forth. Those are the dharmas of form. Right? And then it has mind dharma, number two, called citta. You see that? Starting from the left. Citta is a generic term for mind. So you can apply it to any aspect of mind. But it's a term that covers mind in all of its aspects. But you notice that there's only that one designation for citta, for mind. And then, as you go on, it has the general functions, which are perceptions, ideas, will, touch, wish, intellect, remembrance, attention, decision, concentration. And then B, it has general functions, belief, energy, indifference, shame, bashfulness, non-greediness, non-malevolence, non-injury, confidence, etc. You can see these are all dharmas that are present in our daily life, right? And then it has the functions, general functions, of defilement, ignorance, idleness, indolence, unbelief, low-mindedness, high-mindedness, and then general functions of evil, shamelessness, non-bashfulness, and the minor functions of defilement, anger, concealment, parsimony, envy, affliction, injury, enmity, deceit, fraudulence, arrogance. And then there are the indeterminate functions like repentance, drowsiness, reflection, investigation, covetousness, hatred, pride, and doubt. And then there are the elements which are neither substantial form nor mental form. They're kind of indiscriminate, like acquisition, non-acquisition, communion, which is similarity, fruition of thoughtless heaven, thoughtless ecstasy, annihilation, or trance, life, birth, stability, decay, impermanence, name, sentence, and so forth. And then negative. What negative means?
Non-created.
Yeah, right. Not. Not created. Like space and extinction through intellection and extinction due to lack of a productive cause. So these are like causeless dharmas. Okay, so I just wanted to show you those examples. So now I want to start with Vasubandhu. And I don't know, we put this book online, right?
We didn't send it out yet.
Oh.
The link.
Which what? What?
We didn't send the link out. The link that Alan had.
Oh, I thought we did.
No, we sent it to the, we must have forgotten. We sent it to the, was it the priest group?
Yeah, the priest group.
The priest group had it.
Oh.
We didn't, it didn't occur to any of us. We sent it.
Oh, I thought I said to send it. Anyway, it occurred to me, but it didn't happen.
It's all online. This whole book is on, the text is on.
Yeah, but I thought that we sent it out.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, sorry about that. You just have to listen to me.
No.
That's okay. So, this is called The Shastra on the Door to Understanding the 100 Dharmas. So, Shastra, it means a commentary. Or, yeah. And it's a commentary which means, or which has the meaning of for discussion. And this commentary is the commentary of Vasubandhu on the Buddha's words as the world honored one has said, all dharmas have no self. What are all dharmas and what is meant by having a self? So these are the Buddha's words that Vasubandhu is talking about in his shastra. And then Master Hua is commenting on what Vasubandhu means. Okay? And it's translated by, of course, Master Hua and his cohorts. So this is the opening statement. As the world honored one has said, all dharmas have no self. What are all dharmas? And what is meant by having no self? So all dharmas may be generally grouped into five categories. One is mind dharmas. These are the dharmas that that we use for of consciousness. And then there are dharmas which are interactive with the mind. These are our thoughts and good and bad thoughts and activities. And then there are the three is form dharmas, which are the body dharmas, dharmas of form, like eyes, ears, nose, hands, and feet. And then there are dharmas that are not interactive with the mind, and unconditioned dharmas. So the dharmas that I'm going to talk about, you won't find them there, because I'm talking about them now. Yeah, that's not these dharmas. What makes this different than the ones I've shown you that Vasubandhu introduced are the dharmas of consciousness, which you don't have. You do have them, but you have them in a diagram. And the diagram is this. And I've talked about them quite a bit, although you may not remember. These are called the eight consciousnesses, the eight aspects of consciousness. So, consciousness, the model of consciousness which Vasubandhu presents in his 100 dharmas, it makes them distinct from the other dharma formats. This is what makes it a Mahayana text, is that the dharmas of consciousness are this is a model of the dharma of the dharmas of consciousness. So what I want to emphasize in our study is these dharmas of consciousness and the dharmas that are interactive with consciousness. and the formless dharmas. The other dharmas are not as important. So there in this sequence, the fivefold sequence, because the first are supreme. The first meaning the dharmas of mind, the eight mental dharmas of consciousness, which I'll expound soon. The second interact with the first, and the third are shadows manifest by the previous two, and the fourth are the positions in which the previous three are not found, and the last are revealed by the previous four. The last ones are the formless dharmas, which are like the result of meditation, basically. The formless dharmas are the dharmas that are associated with meditation, like space and so forth. So the first nine dharmas include, in general, eight. And actually, specifically eight. Even though it says in general, eight. Rather specific. So the first five of the mind dharmas, starting at the bottom, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, and body consciousness, or touch. So these are like, I just thought about this when I was sitting this morning. It's like a tree, like the roots of the tree are these doorways of consciousness. The eye is a doorway, the ear is a doorway, the nose is a doorway, and then we suck up the nutrients from the earth through these doorways. These doorways are only operative in an earthly way. What we hear, what we see, what we feel, what we smell, and so forth. So these are the doorways to consciousness, as Huxley says. The doorways of consciousness are these five senses. So these five senses are dharmas. But in order to manifest as consciousness, it needs another dharma called mind consciousness, which is called, there are two names. One is manas and the other is mano. In vijnana, there are certain terms that we should understand that are Sanskrit. I'm not going to burden you with all these Sanskrit terms, because that may be not so good, but certain terms we should understand. Vijnana means consciousness. So the sixth one, mind consciousness, is called mano, vijnana, in order to distinguish it from manas, vijnana. Manas is the seventh consciousness, seventh level of consciousness. So the sixth one is mind consciousness, mano vijnana, which distinguishes between the areas of sense. So mano vijnana, the eye perceives something, that what it perceives is the object. And the perceiver is the subject, called consciousness. So there are two divisions. One is called the seeing division, and the other is called the object division. And what's in between them is the organ. So in order to see something, there has to be the object, which is called the book. We just call it the book. It's not a book, but we call it the book. And then there has to be something that sees, or something that creates the action that consciousness sees. Consciousness sees, the eye doesn't see. The eye is simply a transporter or an organ that connects subject and object. And then mind consciousness, manovijnana, says something is seen, the book is seen. Manovijnana doesn't say, I see the book. Manovijnana says, the book is seen. We never say, I in this subject, because I indicates a self. So there's only seeing sees. Consciousness sees. This is why consciousness takes the place of itself. But we have this tendency to want to sum it all up by saying a self. I, me, and mine are three selves. So mind consciousness does not designate an I. It simply registers and thinks. It does think, but the thinking mind is not yet self-centered. The self-centered consciousness is called manas. That's the seventh consciousness. The consciousness that thinks and cogitates. The one that's thinking all the time. And what we call myself. I'm thinking. You know, but thinking is just happening. So, the mind consciousness is connected with manas consciousness or self-consciousness. And when mind consciousness perceives seeing or hearing or touching or whatever, registers and thinks and cognates it, manas consciousness says, oh, that's a book. I know that's a book. And doesn't get any further. So, Alaya consciousness, the eighth consciousness, is called the storehouse. The storehouse of all the impressions that we've ever had in our life, and from beginningless time. We tend to think of a lifespan. The Buddha says, when you think in terms of a lifespan, that's ignorance. When you think in terms of a self, that's ignorance. When you think in terms of a person, that's ignorance. So, the Alaya, Vijnana, and Manas, both, are didn't just start at birth, but from beginning this time, is collecting seeds from, you know, forever. So these seeds are deposited in the Alaya Vijnana. And then when the seeds are the seeds of all our actions, all our thoughts, all our feelings, that everything that ever happens in our mind and our actions. And so this is the bank of memory. Yeah.
How personalized do you see this, Alaya? Do you see it like a collective unconscious? Do you see it like a big basement with some kind of flimsy partitions between it that all our stuff is in.
Not Freud, but
Jung,
kind of, he thought maybe the Elia-Vijnana was close to the collective unconscious.
What do you think?
I don't know. Could be.
But I mean, I think what I'm getting at is, just for clarification, it's so far when we're talking about these senses and consciousness, we're talking about something that we perceive as existing within one's own particularity, and Elia has implications beyond that. Yes.
Well, that could be, but that's not the way. You know, possibly so.
But it could also just be all of our stuff, which is vastly not the ego things and so on, just the whole accumulation of jillions of things that have ever happened.
Well, there's two aspects. See, this is where we get into there's this big book called The Chan Wei Shi Lun that is a compendium and of commentaries on Vasubandhu's 30 stanzas, the Trimsika, which I'm going to talk about later. And there are all these arguments about, you know, every detail. So everybody has an opinion. So let's, you know, tons of opinions, and the whole thing is about the opinions on each aspect. So, but there are two aspects of that seem to be agreeable: is that there the old seeds and new seeds. So, you know, when we're born, we seem to have certain tendencies. Each one of us has our own independent individual tendencies, and some of us easily do, you know, go one way and some go another way. And well, why is that? You know, where do these tendencies come from? So there are inherent tendencies and tendencies which are not inherent, but when the seeds are watered, it's called perfuming, right? So when we do something, an act, and that act perfumes this, even deposits a seed, okay? And then when we act again, that act fumigates or perfumes, it's called, a seed, which opens up the seed. And so then we have habit energy, because we keep doing the same thing over again. So, you know, you can see how obsessed we are with doing one thing, doing the same thing over and over. Even though we want to change, it's hard to change because the habit energy of each time we do something, it deposits another seed. And so it's kind of an endless round. And the whole purpose is to see into how this happens so that we can have some insight into how to stop this habit energy from dominating our lives.
So the new seeds are the seeds that are created from our particular life, during our particular life. The old seeds are all that we've inherited genetically, culturally, linguistically.
Right. Yeah. But Ross had his hand up.
Well, that was pretty much our question. We started saying that the Elia does not begin at birth.
Right.
So the old seeds are what's inherited through what coexists.
Yeah.
Can any of the seeds exist independently of all other factors? Meaning, how can they be just personal when I'm positing that any seed that gets laid down in the face of other factors, some cultural, some historical, some interpersonal, some dependent on many different things.
Well, you know, every act is interdependent with other acts.
Exactly.
But the seed is the seed. In other words, when you have an apple, it's not an orange.
But that apple wouldn't exist if the bird hadn't picked up the seed, flown off, deposited it in fertile ground where a tree could grow.
But it's still an apple. Those are the conditions that are conducive to making the apple sprout. So there have to be conditions. That's called perfuming. The apple is perfumed, so to speak, when it drops off the tree, and then you can smell it too. It smells great, you know, when it's ripe. And so, and it drops its seed, but it always comes up as an apple. So seeds don't interbreed. Strictly speaking, I mean, who knows? This is called the unknowable, because nobody knows. Nobody can possibly figure out. You can figure out the gene pool, but you can't figure out the karma from beginning of this time, how all that comes about. It's too complex.
This may be related to Andrea's question. Let's say a person has a tendency to be nice. That tendency is, we could look at saying that there's aspects of their alaya that where there's been this perfuming of nice traits.
Yeah, or nice, or not a dharma, but
compassionate actions, warmness, whatever.
Yes.
So then, and in our practice place, we try to cultivate those aspects.
Good seeds, yeah.
Good seeds, so to speak. So when we encounter someone whose seeds have not been either perfumed, we still feel that there's a potential for those seeds to come forward, even though they don't seem to be present in this current incarnation.
Yes.
So the seeds are kind of
latent.
They're latent, but they're not. But they're still separate. They're still seed is separate.
Yes. Well, they're all separate. Every seed is separate. The seed is a seed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it would be different. How would you see it as different?
Well, it's sort of like, how do we don't want to like replace, we want to like cultivate certain good seeds and like not nourish or encourage so-called bad seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we have to accept that all these seeds make up us.
Yeah, we have the potentialities for. Some people, see, if those seeds, say, in this lifetime, are not nourished, if, say, like, the seed of ill will is not nourished, then it atrophies. It can atrophy. And also, through practice, the seeds can... The alaya, according to Vasubandhu, the alaya, when it reaches the stage of, when you reach the stage of a hardship, the alaya ceases to function. It's not producing good or bad seeds. So one is free. That's called freedom. Bodhisattva doesn't go there. Bodhisattva stays in the world of seeds, of alaya.
So in a sense, the Bodhisattva is still accountable for their...
Yeah, Bodhisattva has to be very careful because they stay in order to encourage other people.
But the seed, when you say seed, it's a metaphor.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course.
So, like, if I'm a nice guy and you're not, and I keep saying nice things, and then you... The seed occurs in you, and it may come forward in you. Is kind of what you're saying. You're saying, right? It's not that the seeds. These seeds don't necessarily all exist inside us, or do they? All the seeds.
Alaya is called. There's no place where you can find that it abides. for one thing. And it morally is neither good nor bad. It's totally indifferent. It's simply a place where this, it's the bank, and it's not corrupt. It's the seed bank, right? So, but it holds all the seeds of good karma and bad karma. So, if you're, you know, if there's a guy, somebody has ill will against you, and you have goodwill toward this person, is that what you're saying?
That's good.
What are you saying?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, well, one thing I wanted to get clear was that it's metaphor.
Oh yeah.
Seeing is metaphor.
Well, yeah.
But the other thing is that
it may be a metaphor.
Yeah, but and, you know, in some ways, you're saying not only the Alaya is open to any kind of seed to become. You're open to become almost anything.
That's right. It's up to you.
So almost everything is contained within it.
Everything is contained. Yeah, it produces the dharmas.
So you're like a blank, not a blank slate. You have tendencies, but you have.
When you say you have tendencies, you're saying you're positing a you. There are these tendencies. And they're held as potentialities, right? You can call them potentialities if you want to, but they're called seeds, right? So they're called seeds. And when you think about, well, what does a seed look like? It can be a seed without your conceptual vision of what a seed looks like, right? So I think seed is okay. But potentialities, I think it's also because that's what a seed is. It's a potentiality. They found seeds there have been seeds found in pyramids that the scientist or the investigator has sprouted after 3,000 years. That's pretty amazing.
So, is it possible to set intentions to burn bad, what we would consider bad karmic seeds?
I almost got what you...
Kind of burn, I've heard the same...
Oh, burn. Burn up?
Yeah, to kind of set intentions to burn one's karmic seed or negative karmic seeds in the consciousness.
Well, that's a kind of metaphorical... burn. I suppose so. I would have to know kind of a little more like what.
Well, maybe if like I have a habit that I'm tired of that I can see is hurtful, so I set an intention that, and I renounce practicing like the intention. But then there seems to be that aspect of interaction and entangled karma within groups or family,
right,
that my ignorance keeps me from knowing. So I'm wondering if it's wishful thinking that we can break karma, or is it actually possible?
Yeah. Well, I think that you can reform. It's interesting. If you go to reform school called jail, and they put you on the rock pile, and you know, like studying rocks all day, that's burning up your karma. That, because it's reform. They used to call it reform school. So, but now they call it something else, juvenile hall. But it used to be reform school, so that. You can, through your repentance, you burn up your karma. Yeah. So remorse is a dharma. Is one of the wholesome dharmas. Is remorse. So, that's all I want to talk about Elia for the moment. So I think we should talk about the dharmas that are interactive with the mind. So the fact, the dharmas that are interactive with the mind, which we call wholesome and unwholesome, first I want to say that dharmas are, what's wrong with dharmas? What's the problem? The problem with dharmas is that they're ego builders. So we associate these dharmas with as myself, and we build a self on. We build a self. We construct a self on the dharmas, out of the dharmas. So they're good dharmas and wholesome dharmas, rather than good, I think. And then they're afflictive dharmas. So the 11 wholesome dharmas here are, the first one is faith. The second one is vigor or effort. The third one is shame. The fourth is remorse. So shame and remorse kind of go together. Shame is like conscience, and remorse is actually called integrity, because if you feel remorseful for your actions, then that's actually an act of integrity. You know, when you see these criminals sometimes who shoot people indiscriminately and they have no remorse, right? So that somewhere deep down there is remorse, but they don't have the integrity to bring it forth. So remorse is an act of integrity because it's facing yourself as you are. And then absence of greed, absence of anger, absence of stupidity or delusion. So these are always, in all the dharmas, dharma lists, these three, absence of greed, absence of anger, and absence of stupidity is the positive. But absence of greed, of course, is generosity or control, self-control. And absence of anger is self-control. And absence of stupidity is hard to deal with. He calls it stupidity, but it's usually called delusion. Those three.
This is that a moha?
Yeah, a moha.
In the later revision that the committee did, same text, same commentary, they translated it as foolishness.
Foolishness.
Stupidity.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
It's the same one, but just very, very
little. Yeah. So, that's good. Foolishness. It's also called ignorance. So, you know, absence of greed, absence of anger, and absence of stupidity are conditions for nirvana. If those three are totally absent, they're conditions for nirvana, because there's nothing holding us. Yes.
When they use the word ignorance or stupidity or foolishness, is that specifically related to seeing, you know, kind of that there is no self, or is it just general ignorance?
It's belief in a self.
Okay.
Yeah, specifically, it's belief in seeing things, as Kanzi says, seeing things as they're not.
Those are the absences of the absence of three poisons.
The absences of the three poisons, yeah.
Yeah.
So then, light ease, which means composure, which is attribute of meditation. And non-laxness, which is called effort, and renunciation, which means not clinging to a self. Renunciation really means letting go of self-belief, there are four things, but I'll introduce those later. And then non-harming, ahimsa, which is like Gandhi's example. So those are the 11 wholesome dharmas that are mentioned here. And then the six fundamental afflictions are greed, anger, and delusion. Those are the opposites, right? And then arrogance or conceit, and doubt. Doubt means skepticism. Doubt can actually be wholesome. So some of these, you know, although they are generally in these categories, they're not really fixed. Doubt is really important because it's the counter to faith, which is faith wants to go and doubt wants to hold back, right? Yeah.
Skepticism about the teaching.
Yeah, skepticism is more what is meant. Skeptical doubt is the doubt that's intransigent.
But is it specifically about the teachings of the Buddha?
Yeah,
the skepticism.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's specifically about the Dharma.
About cynicism.
Yeah, cynicism is an aspect of that. Yeah. So then there are minor. They're derivatives of those major. These are called fundamental afflictions, right? And then there are derivatives of those afflictions. So, greed, anger, stupidity, arrogance, doubt, which is cynicism but cynicism is different, a little bit different, because it's more like insincerity, which is, you'll see down here, I think, under deceit. So improper views means not understanding the Dharma, or seeing things dualistically, basically. Views is a unwholesome term in the Dharma. Holding views means having an incomplete understanding, because views are mostly partiality. So then there are 20 derivative afflictions from those basic ones. So, of the three, anger, there's wrath, which is really strong anger, and then there's hatred, and then there's rage. So I think we've all experienced those three at one time or another, or all three together. There's also the aspects of fury and enmity. And then there's covering, which is concealing, not being open. And then there's deceit, which is like false kindness or dishonesty duplicity, maybe. And then flattery, which is to gain favor by complimenting, and conceit, which is thinking more of yourself than you are, thinking of yourself as, of course, holding yourself above others. And harmony, in one way or another, is. And then, of course, there's jealousy and envy, and stinginess, which is withholding. And then there are two, which is called lack of shame and lack of remorse, which are the opposites of shame and remorse. Lack of shame could be your self-righteousness. No concern for the feelings of others. Lack of remorse can be, or society. No feeling for society or other people. And then there are eight major grade afflictions. Lack of faith, which is like not having a focal point. Faith means having a focal point. Something that you are following. Often we lead, but we don't know what we're following. We have to be following as well as leading. This is an interesting point. When we're just leading, we don't necessarily know where we're going. But following and leading at the same time is what we call riding the wave and following the wave. So you're always at the crest of movement, so you know where you're going. And but this is also tied in with faith and doubt. But faith wants to lead, but it has to go somewhere. And doubt actually helps you, because it says, don't go there. Don't go there. Go this way. So doubt is really important, because it's the balancing point for faith. But skepticism is standing outside and throwing rocks. You know. That's different. Yeah. So, lack of shame and remorse, and the eight major great afflictions, lack of faith, not having a focal point, laziness and laxness and torpor are three connected, related. You know, laziness is indolent and an energy blocker, and laxness is not following the rules. You know, I want to get up in the morning, but I can't quite do it. Or being late. And torpor is being vague and hazy. Torpor. So these three are not able to move. Laxness is like not being mindful. Laziness is like, oh well. And torpor is not being able to move. And then there are the three opposites. One is restlessness, distraction, and improper knowledge.
It's interesting. His commentary on torpor is very relevant for maybe some of us. This is the affliction of wanting to nod off during the sutra lectures. In fact, it does not matter what one is doing with this affliction. One wants to fall asleep in the process. Reading the sutra, one wants to fall asleep. Bowing to the Buddhas, one wants to nod off. While translating sutras, one has the urge to sleep. Anyway.
That's good, thank you. And then there's restlessness, which is not being able to settle. Walking back and forth, can't make up your mind. So it's a kind of lack of control in a way. Distraction is more of a lack of control. Just allowing yourself to be carried off by whatever comes along. Improper knowledge, like sticking to dharma, maybe. Or sticking to something literally. This is a really important point. You know, in Zen, you never stick to something literally. Everything that you read, you should not read it literally. This is where people get hung up. But it said there that everything has to be interpreted according to your, and if you can't interpret it, that if you can't digest it, that's good, because then it helps you to come up with to dig into your own psyche to come up with something.
It's also related to the distraction, though, I think, because often in a discussion some point will come up and people seize on, here's this little bit of knowledge and that reminds me of this other little bit which I will say, and so it's kind of a knowledge oriented distraction where you're just going from bits of information
and just get carried away. That's right, I agree. So then there is restless, distraction, improper scatteredness, which means you just can't get it together. Just can't get your mind together. Can't focus. There's no way to focus. So then there's the four unfixed dharmas. One is sleep. One is regret. One is examination. And one is investigation. So, sleep here means more like sleepiness or too much sleep. Don't yawn. Or not getting enough.
What does it mean by unfixed?
Well, it means that it's not good or bad or right or wrong.
In other words, like sleep is okay.
Sleep is sleep. Sleep is sleep. Regret is something about what you didn't do, right? Something that you didn't do. And examination is like Zuigon calls master. Zuigon, yes, master. Are you there? Yes, master. Don't be fooled by anything. Yes, master. So he's answering and he's asking and answering himself. And so investigation is like study or discursive thinking. So then there are the form dharmas: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, feelings, sounds, smells, flavors, objects of touch, and so forth. Yes.
Just what I'm understanding by unfixed is that they can go either way.
They can go either way. Yeah.
That you know, sleep is fine.
But too late.
If you're sleepy, regret is useful. But if you're stuck in it and you wallow in it, then it's a hindrance. The same thing with investigation. You know, if you're caught in perseveration, you know, in a cycle of investigation, you know, then you're out of the moment. But each of these is also a positive quality.
Right, that can go either way. I think that's good.
In his commentary, brother, he speaks to what Diane was asking about.
Mm-hmm.
He says, that is what I was talking about when I advised you before that you could now eat more afflictions. Previously, you did not know, but now, when you get angry, you can wonder whether you should be using wrath or hatred. Before, you did not understand there were so many afflictions to choose from. And now you know it has greatly expanded. But you have this choice. And the thing about once these are laid out, you have some choice about whether you want to use an affliction or whether you have a more systematized way of looking at it.
Right. So you don't have a choice when the affliction arises.
Right.
But you do have a choice about what you do about the affliction.
Right. So you eat it. I think that's what Diane was asking. I did read the rest of the paragraph. But you can. Anyway, you can eat it and take it as food, or you can eat it and shit it out. You know. But anyway.
So just the shitting it out, kind of reacting and the eating it, kind of responding. Is that
I just say this is my interpretation, not interpretation as it was.
Well, that would be letting it go. You can ingest a different thing. You can ingest it. When it comes up, you can chew on it and then let it go. That's the hardest thing for a lot of people, is to let it go, because we think it's hanging on to me, but actually we're hanging on to it, right? So what happens if we let it go? If we let it go, then we feel, well, I'm not being loyal to my feelings. I think this is a big good question. I'm not being loyal to my feelings if I let it go. That's why we obsess on things. You know, I can't let this go. You know, because if I do, I'll not be loyal. You know, if I don't think about my friend's problem all the time, then and let it go, then I'll be disloyal to my friend. So we have to hang on to that. But actually, it's not so, because you can let it go, but it's still there. But you're not attached to it. The other thing, way is that you digest your anger. You eat your anger, but it becomes transformed. If you're a Zen student, your anger becomes transformed into kindness or sympathy or whatever.
It's a
understanding.
It's a vigor.
Well, vigor, I mean, is the motivational thing. It's the action.
Well, anger is energy, and then it's like, well, how are you
well, going to? Okay, I see what you're saying. Yes,
you
that energy.
Funnel it or put it to
right.
Turning Dharma with a wheel or digging a hole or what?
That's right. You can either turn the wheel or dig a hole. So you have the ability to use that energy in various ways. I used to talk about this as like if you imagine a boiler, big boiler, you know, like a and then there's a fire under the boiler, and when the fire turns way up, a lot of energy comes up, right? And then there are these pipes coming off of the boiler, and one pipe is anger, jealousy, love, sex, whatever, all of these pipes to ways of expressing that energy which is built up because of the fire. Then there's also on top a relief valve. But when unwholesome dharmas are dominating, then the relief valve is like, you press the relief valve to let go of the pressure. But there's also the transforming, the blades inside can redirect the energy. So if I'm really pissed off at somebody, I can direct the energy toward understanding. Why is this happening? What am I contributing to this? We always blame the other person, you know. Well, what am I contributing to this? This is only happening because I'm contributing something, just the way I look. You know, I don't like your looks. Well, that's not my fault, is it? Well, it's not a fault, but that's your contribution. You know, because you're there, something happens. So, you have to understand, you know, if we turn our anger and ill will or whatever to wholesome dharma of one kind or another, basically understanding, trying to understand how this is happening, then we're no longer standing on anger or being pushed around by it, but we're residing in a wholesome dharma. So that's called transformation, and transformations are really an important part of this whole thing.
It's kind of interesting, but speaking of kind of what Diana was saying, the burning and things. When I was younger and could play full court basketball,
yeah,
I would play 2 hours straight. I would go into a pickup games feeling upset about something. By the time I was finished, it was all gone.
Exactly.
The endorphins released and all that. So it's kind of interesting what's going on physiologically.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And so these dharmas arise, and what is this? They arise, and their only support is the way we feed them. Because they only arise for a moment. Every dharma only arises for one kasana. A kasana is just a short moment, from kasana to kasana.
But there was something about that exercising that just burned up. I wasn't bothered.
Yes. Well, sure, that kind of activity will, you know, is a transformative activity. So, you know, when you all have these kleshas, you know, and you don't know, take a walk, you know, go running, just get outside, do something. And then, you know, like when the dog, his nose is warm, you know that there's something wrong with the dog, you know. Because the nose is starting to be cold and wet. So when the dog's nose is warm, just take him for a walk. And then he comes back and nose is wet and cold. And it's the same, we have that same ability. Go swimming, you know.
I found the earlier reference, which completes the thought about feeding, which is related to what you're saying. He says, now that he said, this will suffice to introduce these 20 derivative afflictions to you. Now that you know about them, I hope you will give rise to more afflictions to the point where you will eat your fill of afflictions and not have to eat food. Then, if there were a famine, you would not die of hunger because you would have lots of afflictions to eat. But I think it's, you know, like really engaging with them, eating them, like digesting them, rather than letting them kind of mold or rot in your system.
Well, that's right. So dealing with them is important. Yeah. Because the more we cover, like covering, right, is one of the afflictions. The more we cover, the more moldy we get, the more, yeah. So that's why, you know, in the old days, they had the twice monthly Patimokkha, the monks, Patimokkha ceremony, where each monk would talk about, sometimes in little groups and sometimes in a whole group, would confess to each other their transgressions so that they could unburden themselves. We have what we call Ryakufasats, which is Bodhisattva ceremony, which is abbreviated confession ceremony and renewing our vows. They did that twice a month, but they did it in more specific, like, and if a monk said, well, you know, I went and did this, depending on what the transgression was, he might be removed from the sangha or given certain kind of punishment or something like that. But that was part of their practice in the old days. We only have, well, we can go into, I don't know about the cooking.
We have to go
and
do cooking, but you can
continue. Yeah. we should probably stop. But what will we do until then? Until service.
There's a Zazen period, and then there's service.
Yeah. At 12, at 10 to 12.
There's a short Zazen period.
Very short. Okay. So this, my plan here was to have an overview, and so as we go along, we'll get more specific.